Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber. This episode of Red Inca is about Mark Butcher's worst moment in his career. We talk about the pair he made in the West Indies, that Sabina Park pitch, not feeling ready, English selection, so much more, and also facing Kirtley and Courtney. Disclaimer, this episode was for a series I was making years ago that sadly never ended up getting made. This recording was a draft, and before I could go back and fix it up, my computer was stolen. And it was in the days before everything was on the cloud. And so all I have left is this badly edited and badly narrated, highly compressed audio file. But the actual story is so great that hopefully the sound quality and editing won't bother you.
You can hear the ball. Feel it go past you. And you hear the thing fizzing through the air. Throwing one of those ninja stars at you or something like that.
On Thursday, 21st of November, 1996, I wagged school to watch Mark Butcher play cricket. My friend Kevin and I were going to see Brad Williams bounce out England A, but Williams didn't play, and instead we saw Mark Butcher make 55. I'm Jared Kimber, and this podcast is my worst duck. Every episode will be the story of one cricketer and the worst failure of their career. This week, it is Mark Butcher on his pair in Antigua.
It wasn't like I was smashing people's back windows in the back gardens. I was out playing at the Oval, for crying out loud, so that helped.
Mark Butcher was born into cricket. His father, uncles, brothers and sister all played first-class cricket or represented counties. His father, Alan, was a Surrey legend who placed 402 first-class matches and one test. He was 18 and just starting out his career when Mark was born.
They had a hard net at the back of the old Vauxhall end that myself and my brother were allowed to use. We'd nick a couple of balls off Jeff Arnold, the coach, whoever it was at the time. We were allowed to go and use that net. None of the other kids were. But cricket, I was obsessed with it. You know, I'd have, which seems bizarre to me now, because now I'd have been a bit more obsessed with it while I was actually doing it as a career. Things might have turned out a little bit better. But you know, I played sort of dice cricket games by myself and scored them, you know, religiously. So I knew that, you know, the 11s of Somerset and Essex and whoever else, you know, through the 80s and stuff. I was just completely and utterly obsessed with the game. It would have, you know, you sort of think back and wonder if things hadn't worked out, quite what would have become of me. Without a hint of arrogance, it never occurred to me that I would end up having to do something else, which I guess is a pretty useful mindset to have, because it just did not occur to me that I wouldn't end up being a professional cricketer.
While England was looking for saviours in county cricket during the mid-90s, Mark Butcher was just an all-rounder, not really pushing his case that much, averaging a respectable, but not barnstorming, 35.
I just made the sort of transition from being a guy who got into the side because he bowled and batted, so batting down at 7-8 in one-day games or in the handful of first-class matches that I played. I always, you know, always in the back of my mind was I was going to make it as a batsman. The bowling thing was just too much like our work. the 90, what has it been? So 95 season, I think, was a sort of like breakthrough year. I volunteered to open the batting in the absence of anybody else who could do it, and had a pretty successful time of it. And then I think the year after, 96, I think I might have averaged 50 or something. I might have averaged 50 for a couple of years on the trot.
You made 1,600 runs in 96 and averaged over 50.
Right.
Pretty handy.
It was decent. I had a good year.
From 1992 until 96, England won a single home test series against New Zealand. They lost to Pakistan, India, Sri Lanka, Australia, West Indies, Australia again, and South Africa. Hick, Ramprakash and Crawley had all been trialled.
Great time of it in the A team. So we go down there as, you know, English cricket's a laughing stock, and the A team sort of rocks up to very little fanfare. And I averaged 50, didn't make any hundreds. at the time, England were also getting hammered by Zimbabwe, or not, you know, the We Murdered Them tour. And it was all very embarrassing, and English cricket was kind of lurching from one disaster to the next. And so I came back from the trip sort of thinking, well, you know, to get off to a half decent start and you might find yourself playing Test cricket sooner rather than later.
That would be the 97 Ashes series. Butcher would be playing against an Australian team who 2 years prior had finally ended the West Indies' reign as unofficial world champions for 19 years.
Debut against Australia, 97. First test was McGrath, Kasperwitz. Rifle nicked me off in the first innings at Lord's, I think. Warn. So, yeah, I mean, they were a handy side.
Those first three series that you faced are, when it comes to bowlers, about as tough as it gets.
Yeah, it felt like it.
In his first three series as a test player, Butcher faced Glenn McGrath, Shane Warne, Curtly Ambrose, Courtney Walsh, Alan Donald and Sean Bullock. All undisputed greats, four of them in the top 10 wicket takers of all time, all of them with more than 300 test wickets. Even the backups were good. Mackay Ntini, Paul Rifle, Ian Bishop and Jason Gillespie.
You came across just a ridiculous crop of bowlers.
Did run into some good ones, and you playing first class cricket, and it's, you know, it's a niche thing that no one really pays much attention to, and then suddenly it's like this is a real big deal. And the bowlers are better. Because it happened to Haydos and Langer guys like that, didn't it? Matty Elliott, they'd kind of, but Haydos, he went to the West Indies, didn't he? Twice, and kind of got nothing. I never played the man. And it never bothered me. The reputations of the guys I played against didn't really, you know, nobody, I never felt that anybody had a sort of like a hoodoo over me. Now, the numbers might suggest that that's not the case. But it didn't, you know, it wasn't like, oh, God, I've got to go back out and face this guy again. It was never that. With me, it was always me. It was always, how am I playing? How am I moving? How am I feeling? And the rest of it was kind of irrelevant.
The West Indies weren't the force they had been. They had lost in 95 to Australia, breaking their magic run, and then lost again to Pakistan. But they hadn't been beaten by England since 1969.
So your mum's Jamaican, and so you would have grown up, I'm assuming, almost idolising the West Indies team as much as England?
Yeah, for sure.
What is it like to go to the West Indies?
It was quite something. I mean, there's a sort of ferocity to the way that they support the game that kind of marries up with the ferocity of the way that they bowled, and the way those guys bowled all the way. I'll never forget about that trip. I think Barbados was the old coach rides from hotels down the lanes, you know, these tiny little narrow lanes, and these guys are driving, no traffic anywhere, 80 miles an hour in these rickety old buses with police outriders, you know. And you say, what are you doing? It's like, you know, it's kind of like everything is going to be done at the risk of your life, you know, in order to get to the ground, and there's just no need. But it was going past all the sort of like the old boys in the rum shacks and the fizzy drink stalls as you're driving past, and they'd obviously hear the sirens coming. They'd know we were coming, so they'd all line up outside, and they'd be standing out there doing the old cutthroat signals like this: "War Shamrock's going to get you. They're going to kill you." Like, this is your driving past on the way. So you're sort of sat there with your sunglasses on, going, "Oh man!" For guys like me, it was kind of like, this is bloody terrifying. That was more frightening than actually the, you know, when you're, at least when you're out there batting, you've kind of got some semblance of control of what's going on. But the idea that kind of everybody on the islands are kind of there after you. I wasn't supposed to play. I was kind of in the squad.
So first test is Sabina Park.
Sabina Park, yeah.
You're not picked in the 11.
No.
And then
we were there for a month. I mean, these are the days when you'd have a bit of a build-up to the tour. So we were there for a month, and I hadn't batted.
In a game?
In a game or in a net, because there weren't any. All right, so I hadn't batted. I hit some throwdowns on a golf cart path outside the digs that we were staying in an all-inclusive place in Antigua. That was all I'd done. So I hadn't played. And then 5 minutes before the toss, Jack Russell gets sick. So Alex Stewart has to take the gloves. So they're missing a batter. And out of, I think it was Ram Prakash, I think John Crawley might have actually been playing in the game. Whoever else was there on the trip, they decided to throw me in there at number three. And, you know, and the rest is history. The first ball goes flying over Stewie's head. The next one rolls along the floor. saw the whole thing. I was next in, so I was kind of sat there watching it, just going, "Oh no, you're kidding me."
The pitch had ripples on it, like a wave that had set in ice. It was, in every way, the very opposite of a flat pitch. In the first over, Atherton had one almost take his head off. The next ball rolled along the ground twice, on the way to the keeper. Alex Stewart played forward to a ball that almost displaced his nipple. And the first ball of the third over, Atherton tried to get away from one that ended up being guided to gully. At 4-for-1, after 13 dangerous balls, Mark Butcher walked in.
Neither Courtney or Curley had actually really run in at all at any point in there, because I think they knew that if they were really giving it full beans, that someone was going to get seriously hurt. So the ball, you know, I'd played against Courtney plenty when he was playing for Gloucester, and he kind of ambled in and just lolloped this ball down on a length, and I just went sort of back to kind of play it, you know, expecting it somewhere around about just below chest height, and this thing just kicked and flew twice the speed that it came out of my hand, straight at my face. So you know, it was just bizarre. No, I had plenty enough time to sort of see it, and enough time to sort of go, no! and that was that. One ball out, you know. And they abandoned the game, obviously, which was the scorer came and tapped me on the shoulder. I was having a rum and coke by the pool and said that your day's about to get a little bit worse. The record stood. But no, great.
Butcher was dropped from the next match before being brought back for the third.
Bank six. Number six was fun, by the way. Oh, what a place to bat. If that was all you did, all your test career, just bat number six, you'd be muted in that game and end up seeing the side home with the greatest 29 not out you've ever seen over the course of about 3 days. It felt like 3 days. To get us home by 3 wickets or something.
The score he actually made was 24 not out of 103 balls with one boundary. But that innings gave England their only win of the series. And with the West Indies winning two, it meant going into the sixth and final test in Antigua, England actually still had a chance of drawing the series. To do that, all they had to do was overcome two of the greatest bowlers that ever lived.
But Curtley bowled a spell in Guyana on the slowest, deadest thing. I think it would have been second innings. And again, I kind of walk out there at number three. And I just remember it being burning hot, and the sun bouncing back off the pitch. It's a mosaic, lifeless thing. And for some reason, I don't know whether I pissed him off or something, but for some reason he just decided to run in bowl, absolute speed of light, just peppered the crap out of me. And there is something about, I mean, the guys who were on the last Aussie whitewash would talk about sort of Mitchell Johnson and the speed he bowled and kind of like the physicality of that. You can hear the ball, you know what I mean? You can hear it and you feel it go past you, the displacing the wind, and you hear the thing fizzing through the air. You know, it sounds like someone's throwing one of those ninja stars at you or something like that. And there's a real sort of physical, and when it hits, if you hit it, when it hits the bat, you know, hits the top of the bat up near the splice and kind of jolts and smashes into your hands, it kind of hurts, you know, really stings. The sort of sensations that you just you can't really appreciate unless you play at that sort of level against those type of bowlers, because it doesn't happen. You know, there's no equivalent to it in club cricket. I always say that Curtley was the best bowler I ever faced. And there's two reasons for that, I suppose. One was because I wasn't very good. You know, I wasn't able to, I didn't have the tools to kind of be able to cope with it in test match cricket. Again, I'd scored runs against him when he played for North End. I'd kind of felt like, what's the problem? What's anybody talking about? But again, he kind of went up a notch. And I was too early in my career to kind of to be able to unlock the riddle or to be able to take care of myself well enough. And so the combination of the fact that he was obviously bloody great as well, you know, just meant that I found him impossible. I couldn't envisage that if he wanted to, I wouldn't be able to get away. Do you know what I mean? I couldn't get up the other end. There was nothing that I could do to kind of like to get him off me, go away, you know. and so that, you know, in terms of you thinking about the guys that I then played against, you know, I got better. I was a better player by the time I faced some of the other guys. But never ever felt like I was being pinned to the wall by him, which is how I felt with him.
Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts and articles on what is happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket 8 is your place for cricket intelligence.
When the sixth test started, Butcher's average was 23.68. He had played 9 tests. He had made no hundreds.
The expectations were so low, you know. None of it felt very real, actually. I still didn't really feel like I was in the team. I felt like I was playing, but wasn't really meant to be. You know what I mean? The way that they'd sort of shuffled the team around and they'd come upon, this batting order by mistake almost. It didn't feel like it was my responsibility. I wasn't kind of owning it, and I wasn't playing well enough to be able to do anything about it, even if I did. But Antigua, notoriously flat. People score 300s and 400s there, apparently.
Other people
who can play. You kind of thinking, okay, it's 2-1 down. We're in the series still. We had the better of things at Barbados. Ramps has just made 100. This might, could be quite a good thing. But the pitch is wet, day one. It rained, and I don't think the pitch was kind of quite ready for some reason before the test match started. And so it was damp. You could kind of put your thumb in it a little bit. And of course, we lose a toss and end up batting first. The pitch wasn't really fit. And you could very easily have made a decent enough case not to have played at all on that day. But there you go, we did.
The Sabina Park pitch had only been laid 2 months earlier, and it was soft. On top of that, it wouldn't stop raining. There were 3 rain breaks before England lost their first wicket. And when they did, it was Butcher, recently promoted to number 3, who came out to bat.
I can't remember if it was Courtney or Curtly who got me out in the first innings. I know they both had a hand in the only pair I made in my professional career.
It was Curtly.
Was it Curtly first innings?
I think it was Curtly in both, actually.
I thought it was one of each. Anyway, you'd know better than me.
3 balls. So
3 balls. 2 fizz past the outside edge from sort of back of a lane, just sort of flew past me, and then I nicked the next one and walked off. Oh, great. Tremendous. But written in my own head, I'm thinking, geez, I'm nowhere here. I'm not really sure what I'm doing. They got shed loads, yeah. Pitch dried out by then. Lara obviously didn't go berserk for a change. But yeah, they then piled on at a really, really big score. And again, it was flat, man. By the time we batted second innings, it was flat. Proper, it's like it's supposed to be. Like glass. But we're kind of batting to save the game.
And you come in at 1 for 45, or 45 for 1. So they're doing pretty well.
Yeah.
And do you remember what happens next?
No, I really don't. I think I must have played some sort of horrendous waft at something and nicked one to the keeper.
You faced 6 balls.
Six managed to double up from the first innings.
You did. I think it was Junior Murray who took.
Was it? Yeah, definitely caught behind. And just a horrendous kind of waft.
It's almost like you weren't conscious of the fact that that might be the last innings you played.
No, again, I don't really know how to describe it. It should have been, I think. Then the brain would have gone, you're not really good enough for this. I had no real idea. I didn't really pay much attention. But I think that the way the cement mixer that was sort of in the English selection at the time kind of meant that you felt that you were in with a chance of having another go. And again, I still didn't feel like that was kind of my tour. I didn't feel like I was supposed to be in the team. It was like I was keeping somebody else's place warm for them while they dodged Curtly and Courtney. that was kind of what it felt like. So I didn't really take it to heart. I didn't have that kind of, I wasn't walking out to bat with the kind of, the will behind me that I was going to go out there and I was going to make some runs, or I was going to get stuck in, or whatever it might be that, you kind of, the thought that you carry with you. It was just kind of like, I'm here, I'm walking out there, something might happen of any use, and more than likely it won't. And it was kind of that. It wasn't like I hadn't given up. It wasn't that. It was just I couldn't find it within myself, or in the belief in myself that I deserved to be there in the first place, that I was playing well enough to be able to do something about it if I managed to get myself in. And I was kind of putting myself in the fates of the gods were going to look after me or not. And decided they went not. Not today, Sunshine. I think I mean, it's, yeah, like I said, it's the only time in my career I have a bad one.
Test career?
All first class cricket.
Never, really?
Never bad one, apart from that.
You know I'm going to go check that.
You're going to go and check, but that's it, of the stats that I don't know about myself, a myriad, that is one that I definitely know. That one I know. Because it stuck with me. It was the ignominy of that. It was kind of like, right, just don't let that happen again. Hiding in the dressing room while I think Thorpe and Nasser are kind of trying to save the game for us, which they very nearly did, if it hadn't have been for an extraordinary barbecuing of, I think Thorpe might have barbecued Nasser and run out. And then the inevitable collapse happened and we lost the test match and Athers resigned at the end of the game. By the end of it, I'd forgiven myself a little bit because there were bigger things going on. You know, by the time the test match was over, there were blokes in tears around the dressing room. Athers had resigned. Everyone's kind of, you know, the world's finished. It's just a disaster, you know. And English cricket was once again kind of in that position whereby you'd had a little bit of hope. It's like, oh God, you know, here we go again, England have lost. Had they not had a sort of like a 26-year-old kind of not really supposed to be there bloke walking out to bat for them at number three, had they had a flying Graham Hick or something in the team or whatever, or whatever, you know, however many of the other batsmen there were knocking around County Cricket at the time who were fantastic players, you know, and proper men, you know what I mean? They were kind of like, you know, grizzled, hardened sort of test players. Then who knows, things might have been slightly different. The word manly comes back to me again. It's kind of like it's tough guy, you know, kill or be killed type cricket.
Did you feel like a boy back then?
Yeah, I did. I didn't really feel like I belonged in test cricket, really. Not just in that side, but it just, I didn't know what I was doing enough. I hadn't learned enough, hadn't sort of learned enough lessons about what to do when you're not at your best to be able to kind of to survive. And the pair is the biggest endorsement of that, isn't it? Kind of just you're blown away. I mean, it's one of the, again, maybe this goes back to my sort of my naivety of just thinking, well, this is always the way it's going to be. I'm destined to do this. Somehow that didn't haunt me. You know, there's been other guys that I played with who, you know, the sort of like the defeats and the failures and whatever kind of wore them down, you know, and they weren't ever able to kind of be as good as they could. And for, unfortunately for me, I was kind of like stupid enough that it didn't bother me. I was quite willing to get up and have another go, you know. Was it for some reason it kind of, because it did it, I mean, it killed guys like Ramps and it killed Hickey and guys like that. They were never able to kind of, they always kind of felt like they were, it was like this, like whatever hold they had over the people that were scoring shitloads of runs, it disappeared. It got wiped away from them. And they spent the whole time trying to clamber around and get it back or convince themselves that some disaster hadn't befallen them, like that someone had cut their hair off, the Samson thing. Whereas me, I kind of, because I didn't have that anyway, it was not an issue, but it kind of didn't bother me. I obviously didn't want to look up at the scoreboard in fucking Australia on my first tour and see test average 25. You know, didn't do enormous amount for your confidence. But at the same time, I was kind of, well, so fucking what? You know, or it's McGrath again, or it's Warney's going to get you out, all this kind of stuff. It just wasn't that fussed about it. And so I was able to perform. You know, I wasn't a great player by any means, but I was able to kind of go out there and perform in a way that was either useful to the team or at other times was more than that. And it never really fussed me too much about the other side of it. You know me reasonably well now. My personality is not weird. I don't kind of get that intense about it. It's not cricket. Somehow, cricket went from being something that I was really obsessed with as a child to being something that I really enjoyed and had great fun at because I was good at it, to being something that I kind of like, almost kind of was able to sort of step back from and look at in a slightly curious, as a curious way to spend your time, you know what I mean? And was it would could get fiercely into sort of like the whole competitive nature of it and wanted to win and everything like that. But never obsessed over it to the point that it kind of paralysed me from being able to play it and enjoy it.
Despite the disastrous first two test series he played in, Butcher was picked to open the batting against South Africa in the next series.
Right, I hadn't really thought of it like that until you brought it up. How the hell did I end up playing any more test matches after that? You know, it's bizarre.
By the time the test series against South Africa came along, I was back opening the batting. It felt like it was my spot. It was, you know, Athers and I. And I was in absolutely, I was in such great nick. You know, it was a complete and utter contrast from the year before when I'd been selected against Australia at home. I just kind of was nowhere. But this time I was totally in control of what was going on. So, you know, had that gone wrong for me, and I'd not scored runs in that series, then I would have been really worried. And it just felt like I was ready to score one, that was all. And I was there. I was in control. I kind of walked out there knowing that there were runs to be scored, knowing that as long as I didn't do something daft, that I was going to score. That I was going to be able to score. It was just watch the ball, and you will score some runs, and that's it. It was kind of embarrassing actually, because the great moment where I make my maiden Test match 100, I nick one through second slip, I think, or third slip. And it's the only shot of that innings that I ever see, because it kind of gets, you know, it's the one that gets replayed back. But I kind of remember up until that point, I actually smoked everything all day. And so it was kind of like a bit of a sheepish grin and a cursory sort of kiss of the helmet, which I never did again, because it was just ridiculous. I was, what are you doing? And got on with it. Time I got out on 116 or whatever, I think the score was only 180.
Butcher made 116 out of a total of 230. The bowling lineup was Alan Donald, Mackay Rantini, Sean Pollock, Brian McMillan, and Jacques Callis.
And did you feel like a man when you made that 100?
Yes. Yeah. It was kind of, you know, we won the series. That was the thing. That was kind of an ugly series. That was as ill-tempered as I can remember it ever being between two teams. Obviously, we hadn't won a five-match series for God knows how long, 13, 14 years. So it was a huge deal. And yeah, so from that moment onwards, I thought, right, okay, I'm in this now.
Butcher would go on to play 71 tests. In 2001, he played against the Australians, who had only just recently broken the world record for the most test wins in a row. And at Leeds, they set England 315 runs. No other English batsman made over 55. Mark Butcher made 173 not out. England won the game.
I genuinely don't remember a massive amount about the pair. Because I wasn't there. I really wasn't. Wasn't there at all. I suppose the stories and stuff around it, I guess. But yeah. Very weird.
My Worst Arc is an ESPN Crick Info podcast by Jared Kimber. It is part of an 11-episode series that you can find on our site, our app, and also all the other places where you can find podcasts. If you like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. In my career, I only ever made one pair. In the second innings, I was stumped down the leg side from a medium pacer because I hadn't noticed a wicketkeeper come up to the stumps.
Part of the reason why I wasn't able to score more, to sort of score higher volumes of runs, was that it wasn't the making of the numbers that was particularly enjoyable to me. It was kind of like the way you did it, or how, you know. There's no way known that I could have done what Alistair Cook's done, because I kind of wouldn't have enjoyed it very much, you know. Even though scoring all those runs, playing 150 caps is just fucking amazing. Swap it in a heartbeat, but it just kind of, I don't think we could have ever done it. I just don't think we could have. I wouldn't have gained the same amount of satisfaction out of it. Satisfaction there was kind of, satisfaction was that on the odd day, you could be Gower for a day, or you could be Lara for a day, whatever it would be, and score runs in a pleasing manner, a way that was pleasing to me.
If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.